Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
EA shutting down game studios has no idea how to manage properly. Shocking. Hope all the visceral folks land on their feet. Those are the words of one man Verhier. He is Mr. August on the Men of Game Dev calendar.
Oh, shit.
He's a mermaid. He is an indie developer who has worked on many bigger games as well. And he is here today in the studio for Waypoint Radio, episode 105 today. And it's Friday.
I think we're odds on Mondays, evens on.
All right, then we're 106.
I think we're 106.
This is 106. I'm sorry. 106. I got so excited about the thought of you and your mermaid outfit that I just like lost image. It.
It's a Mermanvir.
Oh, excuse me. Excuse me. A Mermanvir.
Is that why you went that direction?
Yeah. It's really good.
That's extremely good.
It's really beautiful. It's a beautiful picture if you're not on Twitter.
What year was that?
It was this year.
Was it this year? The Men of Game Dev calendar?
Game Dev 2017. Oh. Four straight years.
This comes fantastic.
From Patrick Klepek before we continue. Say hello to Manvir.
Hello, Patrick.
I will let him know.
That's very nice. Well, thank you so much for being here, Manvir.
Thank you for having me.
And Austin is also joining us.
We've been trying to make this happen for longer than I can remember. Like, it's been visits. It's been like, oh, I'm in town.
Yeah, I've been in town like 5-6 times this year.
Yes. And so
now I'm here for a little bit, so hopefully we can make this happen.
Anytime. And we've been talking for years. I know, like, Danielle, you followed Manvir's career for years, too.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
But, like, what should people know if all they know is, oh, I've seen that dude tweet before. would I believe that guy has on a pink Cameron shirt and a black snapback
high
that
haters.
Says high haters and a lion pendant? Like, other than that, what should they know about Manvir?
You know, I'm a big mouth developer that likes to yap a lot. I'm passionate about making awesome video games and progressing this medium forward. And I got to work on some awesome games like Wolfenstein and the Mass Effect franchise and Mass Effect 3 and Mass Effect Andromeda.
I mean, you go back to the Wolfenstein franchise to, like, the late 2000s when they were,
I think it was 2010 is the year it came out. Like, I was working on it from 2005 to 2010.
Jeez. Oh, wow. Which one, what was the actual Irish?
It was just called Wolfenstein.
It was just Wolfenstein.
Which is hilarious because the new Wolfenstein's coming out. There's Wolfenstein 2. And I'm like, is this technically a sequel to the one I worked on?
Right, well, like, that's the thing. It's like, it is all in continuity. We just, like, try to dig through it. And it's like, the shit that happened in your game is true.
They took the stuff, the Machine Games did a great job. Yeah. Took the stuff that we kind of started with Wolfenstein and kind of continued that story, which I was surprised.
Right.
Because I thought nobody wanted to ever follow that story again.
That game seemed all right. Like,
it was a messy process, but I think we did the best we could with some real bad situations.
Right. And then from there, you went to BioWare?
Yeah, I went to BioWare in Montreal after that.
Okay.
You were there for like 7 years.
Yeah, so I got to BioWare Montreal September 2010.
Cool.
Worked on Mass Effect 3 the entire time. Worked on like the Omega DLC.
Mm. Nice.
One of the senior gameplay designers on that. And then transitioned over to Andromeda. And then obviously worked on that for like 4+ years.
Right. And you were doing what, like combat design and stuff there?
Yeah, so I did like what's called like the 3 C's, the character, the combat, and the controls. So like... How the character jumps, moves, the aim assist, the inputs, the camera angles, all the stuff that was reviewed well.
Right. Well, I was going to say... I'm going to step over the line. I'm going to be the guy who says, like, oh, the shit that people liked about Mass Effect Andromeda, but...
Which is hilarious because my haters are like, you ruined this franchise by writing a terrible story. I'm like, I'm not a writer.
Right.
Like, I complained about a bunch of these things, like, for years and was told, like, I was wrong, and it turns out I wasn't wrong. So it's funny to see that, like, narrative go amongst just, like, you know, the gamer gators and the conservative kind of haters. But it doesn't really bother me because I know what I did. My team knows what I did. Right. I'm real proud of the stuff that a bunch of us did on the gameplay team and the rest of the team.
I mean, that's just the thing, right? It's like, it turns out making games is hard. It takes a lot of time. And often it isn't because a lot of people are bad. It's because some people made some bad decisions.
Yeah. I mean, when you have a team of 200 plus, ultimately, right? Think about the moving parts that are there. Yeah. Think about the number... of decisions that have to be made and how far ahead of time they have to be made.
Yeah.
And so it's a Herculean task. And yeah, like you sometimes you face plant it. Sometimes you stumble. Sometimes, you know, you do real successful. And I've been on kind of all sides of that, right? We won Game of the Year and RPG of the Year with Mass Effect 3.
Right.
And one of the proudest moments of my entire life. And Mass Effect Andromeda coming out was painful a little bit. Even though I had already quit by then. I quit like as soon as the game went to manufacturing.
Right.
Sure.
I think you sent me an IM that was like, yo, it went gold. I'm ready to go.
Yep.
I'm done.
I mean, I was done. Like, yeah. You know, it was a real difficult project and time. But I'm still proud of the work I did, and I'm still proud of the team, and I'm happy that I got to work there.
What does happen there for something like that, where for you, you are working on gameplay design, you're working on combat character, what was the third one?
Camera?
Camera? Yeah.
Or controls.
Controls.
Yeah.
Should it be four C's then?
Well, there's also like cover and things like that.
Five C's.
There's 74 C's.
That's your first mixtape, right?
Yeah. One of those crack. No, I'm just kidding.
Okay.
Don't do crack, kids.
Don't do that, exactly.
Nope, stay
but if
away.
You do, try to get a Pusha T feature, at least.
Yo, I saw King Push last week, man. He's just killing it.
But, like, from your perspective, how early in the process are you like, okay, these are things that need to be addressed if this game is going to turn the corner and become a Mass Effect 2 or a Mass Effect 3 instead of a Mass Effect Andromeda?
Yeah, the problem is that what ultimately comes out with, like, a Mass Effect Andromeda isn't the game that we started by making, right?
Right.
Like, we started by making a prequel called Mass Effect Contact, was the original idea.
Right.
And then as we started testing things, we realized a prequel wasn't a good idea. We went to a sequel, which was a lot of the team was happier with. But, like, we rebooted that game design multiple times. Mm-hmm. And so the version of the game that you see come out is maybe two and a half years of kind of direction. And so after that, like, reboot and reboot, like, that happens because you're bringing up issues. You're like, oh, I don't know if this is going the right way, or this is going to cost too much money, or how do we finish this in the right direction? So it's hard to kind of answer that because it's so iterative and it changes so dramatically.
Right.
But I would say the last couple years, like, I was having concerns about a bunch of parts of the game, including the open world stuff was obviously the biggest concern. And it wasn't just me. There was a lot of us on the gameplay team. You know, I had a really amazing gameplay team I got to work with.
Well, I think that shows in the final game where, like, for me, I mean, I just prefer a thing that we're doing internally. I was just going over a bunch of pieces we've written this year that have been, like, evaluative, non-review type things that we've written. And I reread the one that I wrote for this, and I was like, well, the parts that stood out for me were the very well-scripted, like, careful combat encounters inside of spaces that were handcrafted. Not that the open worlds weren't handcrafted, but when I was moving around those open worlds, like, that combat was pretty good, but when it was really good was when there was a well-designed boss encounter or when there was
That's the legacy that, like, Mass Effect 3 and stuff had before. So we kind of knew how to do that part well.
Right.
And the part we didn't know how to do very well was the more open world stuff, which is real interesting when you see the way that the EA and the rest of the industry wants to go more open right now, which is just a repeat of, what, 10 years ago when, like, pandemic and other people were being pushed to make more open world things. Like, open world's one of the most difficult things to make. Mm-hmm. It's extremely, extremely hard, and it comes together really late. So if you miss, you can miss real hard.
Right.
And so I think you just saw the inexpertise of the leadership and of the team kind of coming through there, and of EA and then knowing how to make that sort of game.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about exactly what makes it so hard to do open world well? Is it just the scope? Is it just the scale? Or is it like, what makes you miss hard when you miss, basically?
So, like, if you take what Austin's talking about, which is, like, what's fun about a constrained combat?
Yeah.
You have enemies. You know exactly what direction the player is coming from.
Right.
You can, like, make invisible triggers to, like, make people spawn in and come in at the right angles and have, like, all the right little cues, and you can build kind of a moment. In an open world, what happens if I come from the north? What happens if I come from the south?
Sure.
What happens if I come in from the top because I drove my vehicle over a cliff and I just came down in the middle? Like, how do you spawn things in? How do the enemies react? Is there cover of all the correct directions that they can handle? There's so many more variables. And then what do you do if the player just, like, pieces out?
We gave
them a car. Like, what happens if they just drive the car over every enemy? What happens if they what happens if they sit on a mountain with a sniper rifle and just want to pick everybody off? How do we handle all of these things?
Right. Not just how do we stop them from doing it. But if they want to do that and they spent hours building to where they can do it,
how to make that fun.
Exactly, because it's easy just to stop them and then they're going to feel robbed. Like, oh, I spec'd all my stuff in this.
Or it's the other way where it's like, or if they do it and it works, they're just going to do that every time. Right. And then it's like boring and degenerative and just like, oh, they don't engage with any of the other systems. All they do is stand on mountains and shoot people.
So they're effectively two different games. And the problem is that now you're trying to kind of meld two different games together. And this is actually hilariously kind of what happened in Wolfenstein, by the way. If you remember, Wolfenstein used to be, it was originally a super open world game.
There were some huge sections of that game.
Well, like that game was going to be fully open world. It wanted basically Grand Theft Auto in Wolfenstein. Which we were like, what the hell is that? I remember when I was at Raven. So again, like when I say that, these are the same conversations I was having 12 years ago when I got into this industry. Like, we're just repeating ourselves. This is the wheel of time here.
Yeah. I mean, it's so frustrating and exhausting to some degree because it's like, I can't believe we're having this fight again.
Right, but a lot of younger people think that this is new, and it's not. It's been like this.
We should maybe bring it into the foreground a little bit into, like, what happened this week and, like, set up exactly. I'm going to just read from that EA statement so that, like, we have. So EA says, this is from Patrick Sutherland. Soderlund. Who says, and this is like his words, not mine, our industry is evolving faster and more dramatically than ever before. The games we want to play and spend time with, the experiences we want to have in those games, and the way we play, all those things are continually changing. So is the way games are made. In this fast-moving space, we are always focused on creating experiences that our players want to play. And today, that means we're making a significant change with one of our upcoming titles. Our Visceral Studio has been developing an action-adventure title set in the Star Wars universe. In its current form, it was shaping up to be a story-based linear adventure game. Throughout the development process, we've been testing the game concept with players, listening to the feedback about what and how they want to play, and closely tracking fundamental shifts in the marketplace. It has become clear that to deliver an experience that players will want to come back to and enjoy for a long time to come, we needed to pivot the design.
Come back to and come for a long time
pivot.
To come.
And pivot.
Pivot's like, a good
2017,
one
2017, pivot. Pivot to video, pivot to Destiny, whatever. We will maintain the stunning visuals, authenticity in the Star Wars universe, and focus on bringing a Star Wars story to life. Importantly, we are shifting the game to be a broader experience that allows for more variety and player agency, leaning into the capabilities of our Frostbite engine and reimagining central elements of the game to give players a Star Wars adventure of greater depth and breadth to explore. The move leads to a few other changes. And then that what goes into is that EA Vancouver is taking over that project. Visceral Studios will be ramping down and closing, and we are in the midst of shifting as many of the team as possible to other projects and teams. Lastly, they were going to launch it in late fiscal 2019. Now, new time frame, question mark. The immediate reaction for this was like, and including from, I think, all of us internally, a lot of critics on the internet, a lot of analysts were like, single-player games are dead. I think we said single-player games are dead. What we mean is like
big budget,
AAA, linear, Naughty Dog style, linear adventure, action-adventure games are dead. And I don't. And then immediately there was pushback on that, which is like, we've been hearing that for 10 years.
Yeah.
Those games keep coming back, which
is
fair criticism.
Again, this has happened 12 years ago. Totally. Right. This is the same discussion we had.
Someone pulled up, I don't remember if it was Schreier, I don't remember, somebody on the internet, so another critic, I think, pulled up a collection of like, here are the 8 times that like different news outlets reported, like, this is it.
Yep.
And like, often from talking to people at EA or Activision or other big AAA publishers who said, no, they're done. The other thing that people pointed out was like, okay, but like, Breath of the Wild came out this year, Nier Automata came out this year.
Mario's going to come out
Mario's
in a week.
Mario's about to come out in a week. Uncharted, the one with...
Uncharted Ladies Only Edition.
Yeah, but what's the actual
Lost name? Legacy.
Lost Legacy. Yeah. Ladies.
I like Ladies
Lovely
Only
ladies.
Edition,
ladies,
you know?
with Beyonce, all the single ladies.
Right.
Yep.
It's exactly
that was the unofficial theme song, of course.
I'm down.
So where do you feel about this? Because I know where I feel I'm curious. If you feel, do you think that this represents something inside of EA? Do you think this represents something larger inside the industry where EA is maybe more conservative than other people and is taking a safer bet? Do you think it is a Destiny-type thing where they're trying to get loot boxes and people to stay and playing a game in the long term?
Oh, I mean, it's all of these things, right?
Okay.
So, so it's definitely a thing inside of EA, right? Like, they are generally pushing for more open-world games, and the reason is you can monetize them better, right?
Okay.
the words in there that we use is have them come back, right?
Again and again.
Again and again. Why do you care about that at EA? The reason you care about that is because people, microtransactions, buying card packs in the Mass Effect games, like right. multiplayer. It's the same reason we added multiplayer in the Mass Effect 3, right? How do you get people to keep coming back to a thing instead of just, I'm using air quotes for the audience, just playing for 60 to 100 hours.
Right.
That's
right.
You know,
right.
that thing. Well, the problem is that we've scaled up our budgets to 100 plus million dollars.
Right.
And we haven't actually made a space for linear goods single player games that are under that, right? But why can't we have both? Like, why does it have to be one or the other? And the reason is that EA and those big publishers in general only care about the highest return on investment, right? They don't actually care about the player, like what the players want. They care about what the players will pay for. Mm. Those are subtly different things.
Right.
And so what's really happening here is you're seeing a very cynical view, I would say, by EA. And you're going to see this from other publishers as well, of saying this stuff is dead. We need more of the Battlegrounds and the Rusts. And like, you know, you're seeing... What is BioWare's new franchise coming out?
Anthem, right? Which seems like it's their take on Destiny.
Yeah, I mean, I can't talk too much about it because I know way too much, and I, you know, that's not my place. But yeah, I mean, it's not a traditional looking BioWare game, right? It definitely looks like a more
third
open
person. It seems like a third person action adventure game with some light RPG elements where there's itemization and loot drops. And in their demo, they were like, "Oh, where'd you get that shoulder rocket launcher?" Like, "Oh, well, I did
I'm
the
not
raid."
Saying you're wrong,
right? Exactly. I'm just saying what they showed us.
So like,
that's all I'm saying.
Yeah.
So like, if that is what you're seeing from a place like a BioWare, right, owned by EA, a place where I worked for 7 years. Mm-hmm. If that's what you're seeing from Visceral now closing and going to this other Vancouver studio, I think what it means is that the linear single-player game in AAA at EA is dead for the time being. I don't think, but just like the all the time, so when I was at Wolfenstein, when I was working on Wolfenstein at Raven, I remember it saying single-player linear RPG or linear shooters, first-person shooters are dead. Right. Then Call of Duty 4 came out.
Right.
And then we were all standing there like, what? Right. And that's when we were able to pivot the design to have less open-world stuff and more linear stuff and actually get that game done because that game was like not moving anywhere. And so games like that come out every once in a while that remind everybody that, no, if you do it really well and you know how to nail it,
right.
you're going to crush it.
You'll find an audience.
You'll find the audience. Like, you look at the games that are being leaders, they're the ones that don't really follow the trends. Call of Duty wasn't a trend for a while. Like, making that style of game, when they made that first Medal of Honor and then shifted to Call of Duty, that was new.
Right.
Assassin's Creed 1 was something new at one point, even though now it's very trite and we look at that. Same with the Grand Theft Autos.
Right, totally.
And so all these different genres, we have to be able to look at it that way. And we have to remind ourselves as an industry that we're not just about one type of game, that we can support multiple types of games. And if EA is not going to do it, then other people are going to fill in those gaps and make a bunch of money, is my say off that. I'm someone who grew up playing single-player games. I love single-player narrative games. That's why I went to BioWare. That's what I grew up playing.
Right.
I don't really like playing multiplayer games because I don't like being called the N-word all the time.
No, that's bad.
I think that's fair. Yeah.
So, like... This makes me sad. It makes me not, like, you know, it makes me feel disconnected from this industry at times. But I also see an opportunity as somebody who just started my own indie company to go, like, okay, well, the rest of us are going to do this better then.
Right. I mean, this is it is also a year where Hellblade came out, right, which is like a game that I kind of bounced off of, but is a small-scale linear action-adventure game in that style, in the style of game that Ninja Theory makes that was $30 at launch or something. And I could see, like, playing with scale could be a way to continue.
So exactly. Why is $60 the only way to sell a game? Is $60 the only way to sell a game because EA, Activision, etc. chose it to be the
only
way?
Made that choice, right?
Yeah.
Gun was one of the first ones. They were like, $60 for Gun. You got to pay $60.
But they could still make a $50 game if they wanted. They could still make a $40 game
if they
wanted.
Could they go the other way? Could they be like, we want to make the Star Wars game. It's Star Wars. We know you're going to pay it. And also, it's going to cost us more, and we're not going to get it. And you're going to go trade it in, and there aren't loot boxes in it. It's $80.
Maybe, but like, I mean, when we're talking about the actual budgets, you need to understand that the amount of money that is at play with microtransactions and stuff. So I can't actually.
That number is
I'm not allowed to say the numbers and stuff, but I can tell you that, like, on Mass Effect 3, when multiplayer came out, and those card packs that we were selling, the amount of money that we made just off those card packs was so significant that, like, that's the reason Dragon Age has a multiplayer.
Right.
That's the reason that, like, other EA products started, like, getting multiplayers that didn't really have them before is because, like, we nailed it and, like, brought in a ton of money.
Right.
And so the numbers, It's repeatable income versus one-time income.
Right.
And yeah.
And I say that as somebody, like, I agree with that based on my own play experience with the Dragon Age multiplayer, with the Mass Effect multiplayer. I'm not a person who, like, who does a lot of loot boxes in games in general.
Right.
But when I find those games that I connect with where it's like, oh, I really love this world. I'm just playing with my friends. It's 1 a.m. I've, like, had a good night with friends. I'm just shy of the money I need for that box, or I need that one more crafting, you know, piece to upgrade my spear or whatever. Like, I'm going to spend that $2 to open that box. And, like, and that's me. So I can imagine what if you have an addictive personality, if you have a lot of disposable income.
I mean, I've seen people literally spend $15,000 on Mass Effect multiplayer cards.
Right.
50. I mean, I'm like, you must be a rich ass like, person. Or maybe it was Andrew Wilson, just like trying to put money back into it. I don't know. What's up, Andrew?
Shout out to Andrew Wilson. Listening, big listener, big fan.
Ew. That works too.
So, yeah, I'm curious about this. Like, Danielle, you're also someone, we just had an episode.
Yes.
Last week, about the supposed death of the immersive sim, the games like Prey and Deus Ex and, you know, Dishonored. Stuff like that. And, like, my whole position was kind of what you're saying now, which is, like, time is long. Like, we will be back here again. Something will happen to shake things up. I guess the other thing is, like, is that thinking too safe? Like, maybe should we be a little more apocalyptic in our thinking sometimes in saying, is there a point at which we should stop assuming that the market will self-stabilize?
Well, yeah. So the thing is, it's like you don't just assume the market will self-stabilize. You fight. And the act of fighting is the impetus for the market to change, right? Mm. So y'all as critics coming out and saying, we're not okay with this, or, hey, this is really sad and this is upsetting, or people fighting back, those affect the marketplace, right? They're not just statements in a vacuum. And so it's all about, like, how you're coming back and the energy you're bringing back and talking about, like, what can we do to make a change? And someone's going to listen to that and notice that there's a giant hole in the marketplace and then want to fill that, right? Mm-hmm. If no one spoke up, then we're going to see something very different. That's not obviously what's happening, as far as I can tell. I don't follow games as closely as I used to because you work in it for 12 years. Sometimes you just want to go to hip-hop shows and, you know, go for a drink.
Right,
That sounds fair to me. I think one of the points we came off of with last week's show was that the AAA indie, you know, this, again, air quotes around that the AAA indie is going to fill in some of the gaps there. But my concern is always going to be, is that actually enough for particular genres? Something like the immersive sim with the amount of animation, the amount of huge levels, you know, tons of assets, I think.
The question is, like, what's Naughty Dog doing next? I think they're the ones who have nailed that linear roller coaster experience probably better than anybody in the industry, right? Like, trying to compete with them is real difficult, if not impossible.
Right.
They're just super talented and know what they're doing. If you start seeing a company like that shift away from any linear stuff, you know, down the road, then I would start getting really worried, right? But they're also publisher owned by Sony, right? So all these companies are publisher owned now. There are no real independent AAA. I mean, there are, but there's not many.
Right. Well, like, the ones that are independent AAA are owned by publishers who are massive, right? They might not be owned by Microsoft, Sony, or Nintendo, but, like, Activision Blizzard is Activision Blizzard.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, exactly. Everything consolidated amongst these, like, five or six, like, companies, right? Especially in the West, at least in the West.
Yeah.
And so I think what we're seeing is a lot of, you know, conservatism with what we want. And because the stakes are so much higher and there's so many less products out, and because the team sizes are growing exponentially, a lot of that is the publisher's own fault. How much middle management bloat is there in an EA game? I know there's a lot. How much is there in an Activision game? I know there's a lot. How many millions of dollars are going to salaries to people who barely do anything useful for a product?
Right. Versus not the developers who are in the trenches who are actually doing
it. Yeah, and not that, like, everybody who's not a developer in the trenches is useless. No, that's not what I'm saying at all. But there's a lot of middle management bloat, right?
Right.
And if you learn to start, as someone who started my own company, I'm just like, well, I don't want to hire these people because I don't need that bloat on my budget, and I'm going to ask for less budgets because I'm not asking for $100 million.
Right. And you don't have that bank to sit on where you're going to take the bet that maybe you'll lose money by having this bloat, but maybe there's a chance you'd lose more by cutting the wrong person or something,
right?
Well, this is one of the things that came out was, like, another person was like, don't trust this messaging. This is spin. Like, anytime a company comes out and says, this is why we're firing a bunch of people, this is why we're closing a studio, is spin. So don't think it's because of the single player thing. And it did come to my mind of, like, well, like, I know that Andromeda had some issues during development. I know that other EA games have had some issues during development.
BioWare Montreal's closed now, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Is there a world in which, like, EA just has a problem in middle management in terms of budgeting that other companies don't have as severe problem or have different problems?
Or their problems haven't come out yet, maybe.
Right.
I mean, I think just EA being one of the second biggest after Activision company is just going to be that way, right? Yeah. But the answer is yes, they have a giant problem there. Okay. I think Activision had a problem too when I was at Activision. I don't know what Activision looks like today.
Sure.
That was like 7-8 years ago now.
Right.
But like, I think a lot of these publishers have that problem. So the issue is that they're asking for these games to be made and they're giving you, like, you know, large budgets, but where is that money going? Is it going to the salaries of the people? Is it going to the voiceover actors? Is it going to those things? A lot of it is, but a significant chunk is not. And I think what we have to do is take a look back at, like, how we got here. And from EA's point, like, if I look at what EA does, I mean, to me, it's just mismanagement, right? EA had no idea how to manage BioWare Montreal. There was poor leadership in many positions. Not all, but some of the positions at BioWare Montreal. That's part of the reason that we got shut down. I was gone before the shutdown and stuff, but, you know, I didn't think we were going to get shut down, but I didn't think it was going to go well.
Right.
And, like, it turns out that was very correct.
Yeah.
And so seeing what happened to Visceral, it's the same story of they don't know how to handle this, and they don't know how to fire the right people. So what they do is they close down an entire studio, and then they pick people that they like, and they move them over. The problem is sometimes they pick the people who were part of the problem and move them over. There are people right now working at Motive on a Star Wars Battlefront game who I know to be useless and like not have done a good job on Mass Effect Andromeda. Why are they continuing to have jobs and getting things? Is it because they're white and a man? Possibly.
Yeah.
Because my brown ass got, like, basically talked to all the time about speaking up like this,
right? And not...
And but it turns
despite
out
despite doing what you think is
the right thing, and even if I'm doing it internally and saying, hey, I don't think this is a good thing, and I'm saying it in a fair way, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, this is the thing that you talked about. I mean, so if I go back to, you know, a year or two before Andromeda comes out, there's the leak that comes out that that game is going to be about going to a new galaxy.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And
most
like,
of that was a correct leak.
Yeah, of course it was, right? It's like, oh, it's going to happen between 2 and 3, like before the Reapers finally arrive. They're going to send off a thing, which is like hilarious because there's a late game moment where like you get the reveal of what the setting is, basically.
Man.
And it's like, yeah, I read this 2.5 years ago. that's the whole premise of this whole game, right? But the other thing there was like, oh, I hope that they don't fuck up when it comes to, like, colonization. Like, I hope that this isn't, like, a bad, either, like, a white savior story or a, like, oh, the terrible savages of this place.
Yep.
Taming the Wild
Taming
West.
Taming the Wild.
Yeah.
Like, all of the,
if only somebody,
the white man's burden.
If only some brown people at that studio had mentioned that, like, 3 or 4 years earlier.
Oh, well, at the time, I was
over and over and over again. That'd be really interesting if that had happened.
But the thing is, like,
and they got ignored. That would be a really interesting story, don't you think, Austin?
I think that'd be pretty fascinating.
I wish somebody could tell that story.
Yeah, but at the time, I was thinking, like, okay, well, Manbeer's there. Like, I know he's not in the story department, but like, maybe they'll have someone there who can push. And like, it is the unfair burden that goes onto the back of marginalized people to be like, you have to be the one to speak up. You have to be the one to speak up. And also, when you speak up, are you putting a target on your back?
You definitely become a target on your back. And as somebody who's public, so you become the loud guy, you become the angry guy, and you become the person who's just trying to get all the press for yourself.
Right.
That's how it's read. And so then you start. Then there becomes internal, like, strife. So there's, like, some people who will support me inside of the company, and there'll be some people who literally wanted me fired for years.
Right.
There's some people who are like, oh, this person should never have been hired.
Yeah.
Let's get him out. And I know they were happy when we all parted ways, right?
Right.
That absolutely happens, but it is our job to speak up and do that thing. I'm not going to quiet down, and I'm not going to not fight. So to me, it was like when I realized that I was in an environment that did not accept that and want that, and that was telling me I was being too angry or I was speaking up too much, and basically tried to, like, tell me to sit down, be humble.
Right.
I was like, ton peace out. Like, get out of here.
Finish the work.
I wanted to finish the game for my team. Yeah. I had a commitment. Nobody else was going to be able to pick up my work and get it done at the quality I was hopefully going to be able to, and this is because of how late it was.
Right.
Not because I'm the only talented person out there.
Right, but, like, it's hard to step into a new position and pick up
late,
a bunch of things.
Especially late on.
Late on a project, you just got dishes spinning, right? And you just kind of keep them all going before they all crash.
So, that is one of those things where it's like, how much can one person who is outspoken do good versus how much can one person who is a broken cog in a machine fuck up, right?
Yeah, and I mean, that's the thing. When you're dealing with systemic inequality, systemic problems, right, when you're dealing with the systemic sexism and racism that our industry has and they don't realize it has, right, I don't think anyone's out there trying to be – not anyone.
Mm, most people –
the people I'm coming across, the people that I've had to deal with problems with, right, I don't think they're looking at me and be like, oh, there's a brown guy. He needs to shut up.
Yeah.
I think it's just subconscious like training of like – that voice is too aggressive and looks too mean and is not what I'm used to. Yeah. And also, Canadians are not used to my American East Coast. Like, I'm from the DMV, I'm from DC area, right?
Exactly,
Like, I fit in very well in New York because I can just, like, speak, like, slang and, like...
You're ready to go.
Yeah, like, let's go. Like, get out of here. Yeah. Like, so, like, when I remember when I brought up, like, the concerns about colonialism, right?
Right.
They were like, oh, we're going to address that in a good way. And I'm like, but how? And I never got a good answer, and I would ask that every few months. And I wasn't the only one. There were other people. There were other white people, white men, who spoke up. There's a lot of really good people inside of BioWare who spoke up on this stuff. The problem was the lead writer at the time did not seem to care or understand. And so this is what happens when I think you have a homogenous leadership. The leadership of Mass Effect Andromeda was all white men. They actually put a post up. I remember.
I remember the picture.
And like half of them are bald too. Like they're all like the same protagonists of video games, right? They were just one scruffy beard away from being a protagonist and maybe a little out of shape because our people are not in shape. Our being video games.
It's a lot of sitting in front of a computer. It's a lot of
And a lot of crunch food like pizzas and donuts and
food.
I gained 50 pounds that last year on Mass Effect. I'm like. Lost 20 something, and I'm like, yo, I'm still overweight. I need to go run. And now I came here and I eat a bodega every day. It's really dumb. So
bad choices, right? Because you just moved to New York after this. Like that is, we'll get to where you're going forward later.
So like people brought this stuff up about colonialism, for example, and it was just not addressed in a reasonable way. And then the leadership team, because they have such blind spots, because they're all homogenous. Basically didn't see it as a problem for the most part. Or the people who did not have the power to get the change to the people above them, right? So there were good people, but maybe they were new as lead or something, and they tried.
Well,
but they were being shut down as well.
The thing that's wild is, like, there is no single solution for this thing because I've heard from different people at different studios and different publishers who work with different publishers that like, each of those situations has a different setup that has wildly different processes for where things break, right? So, like... In another studio I know, another major publisher, one of the big three, I'd say, that are not a platform holder, there was a writer I know on a project who was like, I really want to do XYZ. And then that studio, that publisher, has like a home base super studio, super writer team that signs off on everything who will just like be like paradropped into every project and make the final decisions on everything. So it's not even someone in the team. It's someone who's like at home base across the pond who like comes in, gets dropped in and is like, no, actually we want sexual assault to still be in this game actually.
Right.
And it's like that the way you address that problem is so much different than how you address I have a bad person in my direct hierarchy is so much different than my person agrees with me in my direct hierarchy, but then they have to report out to somebody else. And it's like there is no one fixed solution outside of a kind of a larger accounting and like education around all these issues.
I mean,
and from our side to hold everybody, you know, accountable as critics.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you for the most part. I do think there is a solution that starts to get you, and that's a more diverse workforce,
It's hiring better.
It is going out of the way to fight the cultural biases. Yeah. You know, this is not a meritocracy. The meritocracy is a lie. It does not exist. It just benefits white dudes in this industry.
Right.
And there's a lot of mediocre ones who are getting by and getting new jobs and who are not doing a very good job, frankly. And the marginalized people, the LGBTQ folks, the women, non-binary folks, people of color – we're struggling at times, and we're not getting hired. And when we are getting hired, are we getting in leadership positions?
Right.
Are we, when we're in leadership positions, are we are we the faces? Are we the on the stage at E3s? Are we out there?
Right.
Like, this is why it's important for me to speak out, because there's not many people who are like me who have my amount of experience, who have the awards I have under my name, who speak up. And so if there's not that many other people, then I have to do even more.
Or who haven't burned out, or who haven't, like, that's the other
thing. I burned out. I've had two burnouts in this industry, totally. Right? Like, you know, I just took 6 months off effectively to recover from that, right? Yeah. I was basically depressed
and
for
thankfully
over
you were
a year.
In a place where you were able to do that. But for a lot of people who come from marginalized backgrounds, who maybe don't have savings saved up, who don't have families who can support them, like, they burn out.
Yep.
Because everybody burns out in the industry. That is, like, across the board.
Most people don't last 5 years.
Most people across the board don't. Exactly.
I'm not even 35 yet.
Right. And you're old in this industry. Yeah. Exactly. You're a veteran designer. Yeah. You're a veteran in this industry at 7 years, 12 years or whatever. Right. And so, like, that alone already hurts. And then if you're a marginalized person on top of that, you have a higher chance of then not having that safety net to fall back and, like, bump you back in and keep you around. Because – and that's why you end up – that's one of the reasons why you end up with not a lot of us in leadership positions. Yeah. It's like, I don't know. Like, I've said this before, but, like, I don't know where I would be if I didn't have, like, N. Guy Kroll to look up to when I was coming out of college, being like, I don't see any black folks being game critics. Who do I have? Oh, thank God, like, N. Guy is here, and, like, it is – the only thing I can, like, I'm so thankful when I hear from young people of color who are like, oh, wow, like, I can do that. Right. That's great.
And so the thing is that we have to build our own platforms from all the different aspects. I think you've done that here with Waypoint, you know, the type of people, Danielle and the rest of your staff, you have a more diverse staff than most, you know, critical websites do cover video game culture and news. I look at it as we need more black and brown companies that are led by us. So, like, for me, while I'm not quite ready to talk about all the stuff about my company, what I can say is that it's going to focus on black and brown voices and people and intersectionally. So I want to make sure that we are represented, that the company is made up of a diverse staff, and that we are making games about our voices and our spaces. That could be the joy. That could be the pain. It could be all the stuff in between as well.
Awesome.
Yeah, that's fucking awesome. I'm going to take a quick break for an ad. So we're going to be right back, and then we're going to talk about much more, all sorts of intersectionality.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
All right, so welcome back. We're here. We're talking about important issues. And one thing I wanted to chat with you about, Manver, a little bit about, you had a really famous GDC talk like 3 years ago. GDC 2014, it was like a call to arms.
Yeah.
Stamp out the racism, stamp out the sexism.
Really well. We're done, right?
That's it.
No.
We did it, fam.
I wish that would be
back.
Cool.
Yeah.
I mean,
was this 2014?
Yeah, this was like 6 months before Gamergate, right? Basically,
yeah,
or something.
Right before Gamergate.
Like right before.
But I mean, that like speaks to the anxiety that it was, right? Like the building tension you were responding to was already there. We've talked about gamers.
It's
always been there.
It's always
never
been
not.
There. I think all of us marginalized folks have always known, right?
But there was that sense of like, all right, shit's coming.
It's
like,
coming now.
Stuff is starting to spike out. We're starting to see 4chan like people pop up on YouTube more and more. We're starting to talk about the alt-right. We're starting to talk about the neo-reactionary move. Like all of these things felt like they were coming, and you were like, yo, we need an army.
Yeah, I mean, and we did, and we still do, right? Like, I said, and like, even before that, I was on a panel with N. Guy and some other people in, I think, 2010, 2011, talking about that. And my statement was, like, where are the Spike Lees of our industry? Right. You know, now I would say, like, where are the Ava DuVernays and the Jordan Peels of our industry, right?
Yeah.
And, like,
are you saying that because Chirac was so bad, so you don't know more Spike Lee shout outs?
I mean, Spike's kind of washed now, isn't he?
Yeah.
Now
we get to say, where were the Spike Lees?
Yeah.
Because now that, you know, the Avas and the Jordans can say, we had a Spike Lee.
Right.
We didn't have a Spike Lee of video games.
Right. So, like, I'm going to be real honest. Like, that's what I feel like I can do. And at least in, like, I'm not a black person of color, but as a brown person of color who tries to be aware of anti-blackness and all the other issues that we have, we got to start, like, going around that. And that talk was kind of a way of saying, we need to have more of our voices in there in the game content. Mm-hmm. It can't just be the people working on it. It has to be the game content as well, the protagonist. Right.
The protagonist. The,
like, why is it always like, you know...
It has to be both representational inside of who's making it and in terms of it's a two-pronged attack.
And I basically gave the attack on the in-game content because that was easy to criticize and show a line of like how identity and stuff matters for a lot of people.
I hadn't thought about this until this moment, but it's interesting because, like, obviously the thing that you hear again and again and again, right? We hear it less now than we did in, like, 2010. It was, like, the classic, like, what is the Citizen Kane of games, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
But what I'm thinking now is, like, there will never be a Do the Right Thing of games. Not because there won't be something that tackles race the way that Do the Right Thing did, but because Do the Right Thing came out in a specific moment at a specific time in a specific place that reflected those specific, like, cultural tensions.
Yeah.
And the time for the Do the Right Thing of games already passed, and now we need whatever's after that.
Do we need to get out? Basically.
We need the Crooklyn of
we can't have the Crooklyn or the Get Out either because they built on Do the Right Thing. Right?
Yeah.
They built on all the movies about
it's
going to
be our own unique difference.
Exactly.
You were right. I think it'll have some similarities, but it's never going to be the same.
And if anybody tries, it'll be like a shadow, right? Like, I think about something like, I kind of dragged We Are Chicago really, like, badly this year.
I have not played it. I heard things about it.
It's very frustrating, and now that I think about it, it's a lot of trying to use, like, the visual language and the narrative design of stories about race from other media instead of building something fresh from the ground up that actually speaks to the way that, like, Black people live in 2017. And so I hadn't actually processed this until this moment, but, like, there is something tragic that we never got the Do the Right Thing of games because now we can't get that next step. And instead, we're still at that foundational. We need to build that first fucking thing. So, like, sorry, I didn't get that all out.
No, it's good. Yeah.
How do we do that? And then, too, like, to Danielle's point, like, where are we today versus when you gave that GDC speech?
And especially the last couple of weeks where there's I feel like, added emphasis. And I wonder if it's a step towards progress that we're at least starting to have conversations about harassment and at least starting to throw some harassers under some buses. And I hope that continues, certainly. Mm-hmm. But I wonder if that's part of this. I wonder if it represents any movement forward, even if it's just inching forward.
Yeah. So I'll answer the first part first. Like, are we going to get that Do the Right Thing? I'll be real honest. That's basically my goal, right? Like, I'm working on a game that is basically about the war on drugs and the destruction of the Black and brown communities in the cities by the war on drugs and white supremacy. And Do the Right Thing is very inspirational into that. Now, does it take the same story or anything like that? No, not at all. And it'll be very different in many different ways. But that was an inspirational thing. So there are people like myself, but hopefully, you know, I'm still working on raising funding and all that kind of stuff. So it's way too early to know that this is even going to, like, really happen.
Right.
But I have plans. I have some people who are ready to work with me as soon as I can get some of the money in so I can pay people properly. So there are people doing things like that, but it's coming from indies. But then again, Spike was kind of indie back then. Like, he was,
yeah,
you know.
90s, yeah.
He was doing low-budget stuff, so maybe it has to start that way.
Yeah.
So on that respect, I think there's at least one person here who can do that. And I know there's a few other people out there doing that. There's not enough, though. We need more because most games miss, right? 80% of games miss. So we need to make, like, you know.
Which isn't a drag on those
80%. No.
Like, it's hard to make games.
It's hard to make games.
It's hard to make any art. Art is hard.
You can make a good game and it could still miss in the marketplace,
yes,
right?
True,
you could have not marketed
true.
It well. You could have positioned it poorly. You could have not gotten the word. Like, there's a lot of issues. I think that's going to come slowly. Hopefully, you know, over time I can start talking more and more about that, you know, as I get some of my stuff going. And frankly, if I see other people doing that stuff, I'm going to try to promote their voices. I got a decent Twitter following. You know, I'm going to start, like, trying to promote those voices and get them out there. Now, as to the actual harassment and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's another side of it, I know. But
are we doing better as an industry on racism, sexism, homophobia, et cetera?
Yeah.
I don't know that we are. It feels like if we have made forward progress, it's so incremental that does it really matter at all? To me, no, because, like, what's the difference between, like two boots on my head and one boot on my head? Like, there's still a fucking boot on my head.
Yeah.
It sucks.
Right.
Yeah. I know powerful men in this industry who have sexually harassed women and other men, genitals, who have, like, done all this stuff and who are in power, who literally email me and ask, like, hey, do you want to have a meeting? And I just have to ignore them because I know they're skeezes.
Yeah.
Right. I know people who run some of the biggest companies who have done terrible things. These stories exist. People in our industry know. The problem is, like, I know it's not my place to, like, expose that because I put potentially the victims in,
right.
In danger and stuff like that. But it hurts because I have all this knowledge and I don't know necessarily what to do with it. And I think as an industry, you know, I try to talk to especially like a lot of women developers and stuff like, how do we handle some of this stuff? And the same stuff exists for racism, right?
Of course. Yeah.
Like I've heard a lot of anti-black like stuff in the workplace. I have worked for 12 years in this industry and worked with maybe 2 or 3 black folks in the entire time.
Oh, my God.
Right. That's like a
I've worked with more like brown people looking at me like more like
that's not even a 3/5 average.
No, man, a 3/5 would be a like that would be.
I mean, you're not even getting 1/3 of a black person per year, which is that's no, even low like, by American
and
standards.
And 0 times were they actually directly in a team with me.
Of course,
like they were always like, oh, this is a person in the cinematics department.
Yeah, right,
this
you
is
catch
a,
someone at the
this
subway.
This is like an artist that works up there.
Right.
This is like you nodded each other.
Nod.
Like,
yeah, of course.
Like,
yes.
You're in a white space.
Yes.
Because like. We talk different to each other. We code switch, and we I speak white to white folks, and I don't speak white to other like non-white folks. It's really not doing well. And look at the protagonists in games. Has that really shifted? Are we seeing non-white protagonists like running games? Are the Grand Theft Autos having lots of women in their games and stuff? Yeah,
right.
in like the same sorts of roles.
Only
that men,
strippers,
only,
right? Yeah, yeah,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So I don't know that we've made any significant progress. Now, I do think there are indies and stuff that have done, things like, Steve Gaynor, somebody who did some good work, with the stuff that him and, like, Tacoma and Gone Home Before
right.
That.
And that's a team that has multiple women on it.
Yeah, like, and he's like, gone out of his way.
Carlos, shout out, right. Like, that team is a diverse team in terms of gender, at least.
It's all white people. They're diverse on gender.
I think it's all white people.
Yeah, but exactly. So it's like, sometimes you get these other, like, people who get it, but also they'll be diverse on gender.
Right.
But they won't be diverse on race, or they'll be diverse on race and not gender, though I haven't really seen that one nearly as much.
No.
And it's hard because, like, as somebody who's trying to hire diverse people, like, it's hard to find black women who have the time to work on games. There's not that many because we pushed them out so long ago that they don't exist at the experience levels that sometimes you want. And it becomes a chicken and egg problem.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to, like, solve that problem by better mentorship, by, the teaching, NYU's Game Center is here. And,
right.
like, their students are actually fairly diverse. Like,
yeah.
I've gone there and
so it's some good like diversity on the staff too on the teaching staff.
Yeah.
So like,
I have a number of dear friends who work over there, and so that gives me future hope.
Mm-hmm.
But again, we can't, like as we were discussing before, you can't just hope and like wait for it to happen. You have to fight and make it happen. And so that talk was me fighting, and this me here, this is me fighting.
Mm-hmm.
And the more public I'm going to be now that I'm, kind of back after my little year of being quiet and little low-key and it's kind of like, resting and relaxing.
Back to big mouth shit.
Back to
your big mouth shit.
Yeah. I'm just going to, piss off a lot of people and that's fine. I'm good with
good.
That. Because I don't think I'm saying the wrong things. And so I hope that we can get to a point where our game staffs are more diverse and our things are more diverse and that we don't have to have this conversation. But I think we're a long way away from that. I don't think we're close.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And honestly, with this administration coming in, maybe we've got even gone backwards.
Sure.
But this gives us a really good moment. This is a great moment in history to make art that reflects the cultural moment that we are in.
Right.
I know that's
well,
what I'm trying to work on.
It's just like there's a bigger tune in suddenly. Like, I don't think the message that – like I so
white
so,
people started paying attention.
Right. That's
not all,
that's
the song.
Not, yes. But a lot of people are like, ah, shit. I should
should have listened to the little
us. Right. And it is easy to be bitter about that. And I think that is – it's fair to be bitter for like a minute. Like I've talked about the was it the Chris Rock, Dave Chappelle skit on the SNL right after the election where they were like, this is what this country is. It's okay to have
it's
that
been
moment.
This.
It's been
it's
this.
Been
it's a
this
good
way.
Moment to have. It's okay to have that moment. But for me, I wanted to have that second moment, which is like, how do I make sure I don't lose that opportunity? My message between when I was writing as a freelancer, 4 or 3 years ago, when no one knew who I was, and when I was writing about race and culture and labor and all that, has not changed that much.
Right.
But now there is an audience for it, partially because things have gotten more visibly worse for those people who previously had every excuse in the world not to look. And so, like, it isn't even like, oh, I have to pivot my message a little bit. I have to make sure it's – like, no. There is just a bigger audience for it now, and to let that go by would be a waste.
I completely agree with that, right? And like, art reflects culture, and it can impact culture. And so we can make things that say something, right? We have to say something important with our with our work, right? Like, yes, escapism as games is fun and great, and that's fine. And I'm not going to blame anybody who wants to play that. We all need escapism. But there is an imbalance of how much escapism we have to how much things are like have meaningful things to say. And I would hope that we're starting to see more games have more meaningful things to say and talking about like the current political climate or racism, sexism, and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, obviously... I'm letting you guys talk because obviously this is the conversation that should be happening for sure.
You are a queer woman in 2017.
It's true. I understand. I'm just saying, like, of course, I want to foster this environment.
Intersectionality matters.
It does. 100%. I am always of the opinion of, oh God, I really want to see protest games. I want to see games that are angry. I want to see games that are pissed off about this environment. But I'm always worried, of course, about the side of it that is the commercial side of like, oh, how do you make this palatable and marketable
So what about the Far Cry game that's coming out, right? Like, yeah. I haven't paid close attention to it, but like, is it going to be nailing the commentary?
If you check my email, what you'll find is there is a prequel novel that you could read.
Oh boy, a prequel novel to a video game. That sounds like something I never want to do ever.
It's written by someone named... What was it? It's like Urban Wit or something.
Oh yeah!
I swear I thought it said Urban White, my guy. I opened up my email the other day and it was like, you could read the new
Far
Cry.
I want to name this episode Urban White, but I can't. But I want because it's amazing.
I think this should be Urban White.
It absolutely can be. Here it is. Ubisoft to publish Far Cry Absolution, a new novel written by Urban Wait, Waite, based on the upcoming Far Cry 5 video game.
Urban White.
I don't know about Far Cry. I want Far Cry 5 to be the thing.
Okay, so here's the thing.
And I like that people are upset about it. I like that there are people who are like, this is too close to home.
Yeah.
Like, fuck you.
Yeah, and I want that feeling too. But, I want those people to feel weird. But the thing is, I live in Montreal. I have a lot of friends who work at Ubisoft Montreal. Yeah. I know a lot of the dirt that happens inside that company. I don't know if I trust it.
Right.
And
you might have trusted it at like the base level, right? At the like... There are people there who want to tell that story.
Oh, yeah, I do trust that people want to tell the story. I don't trust that it'll be executed well, right? Mm-hmm. And again, that goes back to who is leading the team.
Right.
Who is the people in charge? Are they all white men again?
Right.
Because frankly, I don't trust just a team of that people to get that right because there's so many nuances
there are
and
perspectives
lived experience.
There. Right,
exactly.
That will get
and
shut
we need out. To be able to talk about all those different things. Right?
And just like there are blind spots. There are, I mean,
there's
like,
total
there,
blind
there
spots.
There are things we that you just don't them. See. Exactly. Like I just said blind spots. Yeah. Like maybe I should have just said there are things we don't see instead. Like I don't know.
Absolutely.
We all fuck up in that way, right? Like I
come from a community, the South Asian community has a lot of anti-blackness in it, for example, right? And like we performed that for a long period of time and you realize, no, we're not all in this fight together. Sometimes we perform in a poor way. So like even within minority groups we fight and we don't do well, right?
Sure do.
But the 90s in LA taught us that, right?
Absolutely. And we just talked about this because we were writing about Halt and Catch Fire, which I think actually connects back to your initial point, right?
Sure, sure.
Danielle, you just wrote a piece today that went
up this morning.
The finale of Halt and Catch Fire, which is a show about the computer industry in the mid to late 80s, basically.
Actually, like early 80s into the early 90s. Through. It's like 11 years or something. But
And what was the piece that was kind of about this?
Well, the main
speech?
Focus of this piece, there's two characters who are women. There's sort of like two main male characters, two main female characters, and the women, of course, have a lot of shit to deal with due to sexism, even in the early 80s, even in like going into the 90s, and they're like women in tech. And final episode, Donna, who has actually become like a venture capitalist, she is like, spoilers, I guess, for Halt and Catch Fire. It's not really relevant to like, her character arc, you know, she's a successful businesswoman in this space. She's a former engineer. She's brilliant. And here she is, you know, having like an event for women in tech. And basically the thrust of it is I've had to do shitty things to other women to be where I am. I'm not proud of that. And I really hope that, you know, in when my daughters, she's teenage daughters, are, you know, my age, that they don't have to go to events like this. They don't have to go to women in tech events. That everything is just a little more egalitarian. Everything's a little more equal. And I watched that and I almost sobbed because it was just like, oh, God, in 2017. Well, this was in 1994 fiction.
When there's
and
only
it's like,
one slot or two slots for that person, right? Then we're all fighting for the scraps. And why do we have to fight for scraps? Why don't we get the table?
Right,
like, I don't want to fight for scraps at the table. I don't want to fight for a seat at the table. Right. I want to own the factory that makes the fucking table.
It's so frustrating.
Right. Yeah.
We talk about scraps. I actually just, over on my private Twitter, was like, I saw somebody talking about, I saw a person who I respect a lot, talking about the fact that a major male comic book character is like, long-term relationship with a queer woman, right? As a male dude, it's a male character. It's Batman and Talia al Ghul, right? And Talia is like a queer woman. It's like bi. And it was like, Does this what's this mean? Like, where is this rate on the representational scale? And, like, I'm not mad at that person for saying that.
Right,
what I'm
right.
mad at is the situation where it's like, is this where we are with representation? That
right.
we have to treat scraps like feasts.
Right.
We have to fucking treat, like, any... That Batman, that Bruce Wayne is married to or is in a long-term relationship with a bi woman
right.
counts as good representation.
Right.
Which I'm not saying it doesn't count for nothing, but it's like...
That's real small,
it's,
right?
It's like, we're like...
Yeah.
Like, yo, we can do better.
We can do better. It means that there's an important character who is a bi woman in comics.
Yeah.
Like, that means something.
Yeah, absolutely.
But sure. like... And, like, because of her connection to Batman, it means she will be featured more and more. But, like, I'm making a look. There's no camera on, but, and it's one of those things where it's, like, I just am so frustrated by that on the representational side, fictionally, but also in the representational side in terms of the makeup of companies, the makeup of artists, the makeup of, like, who is in positions of power, positions of creative control. And, like, when you described that to me, one of the things that you were talking about with that scene when you first wrote it, you were, like, I wish that... That we had that optimism going forward.
Right, the
now.
Optimism of the 90s. And then right. there, you left, of course, a great note that was like, 90s actually were terrible.
For other people.
For a lot of people.
For
most people.
There was this moment for this character, like, yes, some people, she had to do terrible things to women to get to where she got
right.
to. She did that.
She's still white.
And she's still white.
Yeah.
Power business woman, right?
Exactly.
Of the 1990s. But like, that episode happens in 94, right?
94, exactly.
Which is like 2 years after the LA riots,
yep.
which we were just talking about.
Yep.
That's why I made this connection. Was like, there's always that other thing happening in the background 100%. that coats any optimism with some shade.
Yeah.
And
I mean,
so that description made
yes.
me then think of your speech.
Okay.
And like, was that speech naive? That like, this is a moment where we could gather in 2014 and we could change things? Or was it optimism in the face of skepticism or in the face of cynicism?
I think it was. I think it's showing that we are and have been fighters, right?
Okay.
Like, I don't think it's like thinking that, oh, we're just going to change this.
Right.
I certainly wasn't coming out with that energy. If someone took it that way, I'm sorry that
sure.
I gave that impression. No, I thought this was going to be real difficult. And to me, it was like a rallying of the troops, like as you
right.
said before.
Yeah.
It is about like how can we all unify, right? Unity is power. Like, how can we get together and do something more powerful and bigger than ourselves
right.
or our individual, like, ways that we look at the world and our own biases and problems? Now, that was, for me, somewhat necessary just to express, hey, there is a problem. I need
right.
you to understand that there is a problem.
You almost did the thing where it's like, I'm not even gonna waste time arguing with you if there's a problem. What I need is for you to suit up.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, because exactly, like, to me, like, there's always been a problem. Like,
right.
I was like I've been dealing with racism since I was like 5 years.
Yeah.
I got called the N-word at age five. Fifth
oh
grade, I got called Rodney King for fifth grade. The white kids would play cops versus Rodney
right.
King at recess.
Oh,
that was a fun game to play when you're brown and the closest thing to a black man in your school.
that they had, right? They didn't have a black
Shout
guy.
Out to
oh
Damascus,
my
Maryland.
God.
No, trash.
So, like, then the follow-up there, though, is, like, so now how do you rally the troops in 2017 when we're so exhausted, where the types of people who are sitting at this table, black people, brown people, queer people, like, people who are not just the bulk of people in power, how do you push through the fatigue in a year where there is not just fatigue in our industry, but there is an additional amount of fatigue in the world? After years of talking about sexual harassment, after years of talking about black people being killed in the streets, after years of talking about brown people being bombed overseas or actually not talking about that and pretending that
right.
was maybe not an issue during the last
right.
administration, like, how do we get the strength to, like, all right, let's get back together. We can't be bitter. We have to be fighting. Or we can be bitter, but we also have to keep fighting.
Yeah, I think it's a mix of a few things. I think, first off, we have to start building our own spaces and realize that white folks and, like, men and, you know, straight folks are not going to let us into the spaces they've already built, that the systems are not built in a way to want to change. I fought EA, BioWare internally to try to change culture. I fought Activision on these sorts of same things. The reasons I left both companies are for...
Cultural
not the exact
differences,
but yeah, it's basically when you realize that you're just running into a brick wall, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I kind of would joke at work. I'm like, I'm a Krogan. I will headbutt a brick wall. But there comes a point where you've headbutted enough brick walls,
right.
and you're like, I'm done with this, right?
Right.
And that's where I hit, and then that's when I realized I needed to start my own black and brown company, and then do the work myself. So one thing is we have to start building that. So I'm hopefully one, but I'm not enough. Like,
right.
I'm not going to have a Maybe hopefully one day I can get like a, you know, a $1 billion company, but like they haven't any. Like,
and even then, there should be another one.
Exactly. Right? Like, we have to have. So where's our BET of games, right? Like where are the things that maybe a little bit more broadly, right? For not just for Black folks, but for Black and Brown folks and intersectional folks as well, on that stuff. That's one way I look at it. The second thing is I think we have to look at people with energy in the and that's youth on usually because they haven't been their souls have not been crushed yet, right? I remember when I was 22, 23, working 80, 90 hour weeks on Wolfenstein, and that was no problem. Right. I work like 50 hours now, and I'm like done for a week. I'm just like faded. I'm like, grumpy. Yep. My knees hurt. Mm-hmm. I'm gonna slap somebody.
You ever notice I'm getting older? The thing that caught me was like joint pain is a thing.
My
that
knees are hurting right now. Just
away.
Sitting here.
I used to be like, if I fucked up my elbow or my shoulder or something, I'm like, oh whatever, it's gonna hurt for 2 days and then like whatever. I
hurts for weeks.
I fucked up my shoulder recently. It's been fucked up for 2 weeks. I know it's gonna go away. Like I know it'll be better in a month. Like last year, I fucked up my foot and it hurt for 6 months.
I'm here to tell you, it might not.
I know. I'm hoping I'm on the one side of it where it never does go away.
I literally separated my shoulder, dislocated my shoulder this year, and it still hurts all the time. And like it just pops out sometimes. Shit. And then like it's like I just took 4 months back. Damn. Like. Or so hangovers last 2 days. That's a fun one.
I hate it.
I can't drink anymore. Father Time. I can't even drink.
Father Time undefeated.
It's okay. Undefeated.
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 Fuck. Man.
You can't
come
out of these streets with him.
You can't. He shows up. And he doesn't even roll deep. It's just Father Time.
Yeah.
Father Time rolls up in an SUV.
He's like, yo, what's up, son?
Pops out the back doors and he says, get in. He doesn't. No, people don't come out.
Yeah. You hobble your butt over there.
Like, get in. And you're like, and you give him a look like, no, like, no. Get in. And you get in. That's it.
Yeah, then sometimes you get bodied afterwards. That's the way it goes.
Father Time. It's coming for us all. Yeah. So how do you – so like given that, given the fact that we've talked about burnout, we've talked about how rare it is that people stay in the industry, like anybody, again, we're going across – we're talking about cis straight white dudes burn out after 5 years too. Like lots of people burn out of the industry. How do you get unity inside of the industry? Let me just say what like everyone writes us every time we talk about this. Like why no union? Why no game developer union?
Yeah, because like nobody wants to speak up on a union, and nobody. A lot of people think that unions are bad. Unions have a bad rap.
But where's that come from?
Oh, it becomes some capitalism because corporations taught us that. And there are some corrupt unions.
Of course,
any amount of power eventually gets some amount of corruption, right? And so you can look at the Teamsters and stuff like that, and people look at that very negatively,
right?
But they forget about all the rights that were given,
right?
That were fought for, that teachers got, that steel workers got, etc., from these unions. And that's why, but like my industry throws shade at like when the voice actors, like the Screen Guild or whatever, strikes.
I recall.
And I was 100% on board with that. I get what they were fighting for. And my industry was like, people, the developers, like, we don't get these residuals. Why should they? And like, no, the answer isn't why shouldn't they? The answer is then why aren't we fighting for that too?
Even that fact was one of those things that was fucked up from the jump because it was framed as residuals when it was really a bonus. And two, there are lots of people in the industry who do get a bonus.
That's correct. I know people make six-figure bonuses on Call of Duty all the time.
Right. That happens. Like, so it isn't even that out of the realm. It's just like it was immediately framed as this thing that you don't get so that you will be opposed to it.
Yeah.
So like, but why is it the case? What would it take to motivate game developers to organize collectively? If not a union, then maybe something that was a better advocate than like the IDGA or anything like that.
I don't know what that looks like because I think it needs to be almost a catastrophic event. Like, what's the equivalent of like a mind collapse? Like, I don't know what that looks like.
Another
in
crash
industry.
Or
because
another...
frankly, like, EA Spouse happened how many years ago? And not like there were minor changes after that, but I don't think there was like a wholesale. Like, we just got minimum wages and like hourly wages paid, and you know.
I mean, this is like,
and that was an important moment. Even in collapses that Aaron, when Aaron wrote that whole letter, but
I mean, this is my favorite. We were at some point hope to do a Blade Runner spoiler cast.
Yes. Oh, Blade Runner is my favorite movie of all time.
Actually, we're gonna do a 2049 one because it just dropped.
I watched it.
So like, my favorite thing about the setting in that, and I'm gonna spoil a very broad thing in the setting of that movie, is that the replicants have a revolution in the background. Like, it doesn't happen in the movie. It happened 30 years ago, caused this blackout, erased all of these things. And the response to that is like, okay, no more replicants at first. And then they start making replicants again. But this time there's going to be different rules so that they're not mistreated. Like, no, actually, here are the new rules. They don't die after 6 years automatically. perfectly enslaved forever.
Yeah. Yep. We learn nothing.
And they get homes and they can buy stuff. Yeah, like, that's the thing. Is like
they can participate in capitalism.
They can participate in capitalism. Yeah. Go to their homes that have slurs written on their doors.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, oh, that's what revolution gets you, is just like a higher class of being lower class.
Yep. Yeah.
And that was like one of my favorite story, like world building parts of that story, is just like part of the reason that people don't put their necks out for big revolutionary action is because the return might not be there, or they might not believe that the return can be
there. I mean,
you
can look at it in a much bigger way, right? Look at what happened with Arab Spring. Look what happened with all these things. Are they in better positions or not? Like, it's a complicated question, because obviously being under authoritarian rule is terrible, and but sometimes what you get afterwards
can also be authoritarian or unstable, or
exactly.
can be, you know, risky for a billion other reasons. You lose
getting killed by somebody else this time.
Right.
Yeah.
So the thing is that these revolutions, they're built. These little things don't happen peacefully, right? They happen through violence.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the history of this world is built through violence, unfortunately. Like, I wish it wasn't, but, you know, I'm also a Malcolm X, like, by any means.
Right. You're a pre-Malcolm or pre-Mecca Malcolm.
Yeah.
Dude.
Yeah.
Is the thing there, like, so we can talk about violence in a bunch of different ways.
Right.
We could talk about violence with Wolfenstein, actually, even, right?
Sure.
Like, you made a game in which you killed a bunch of Nazis.
Oh, it was great to kill a bunch of Nazis.
Before, at a time, when you were working on Wolfenstein for Raven, that was a time in which the industry was like, bored of killing Nazis.
Yeah.
Like, now... what do you feel about that? Do you feel at this point it's like...
Are we talking about killing real Nazis or otherwise? I support both.
Okay, you're good. You're on board with killing Nazis across the board.
Yes.
Okay.
I'll put my name on that.
Yeah. Okay. Put it down.
Put it in the show notes. We got you down right here,
Andrew
killing
Eric
Nazis.
Kills Nazis.
Yeah.
Would kill Nazis.
This is going to show up, you know, if I'm ever in court for killing a Nazi.
It is absolutely going to show up in court. Judge.
This is a prosecutor. So, hey, prosecutor.
All right. I'm not going to say anything else. I'm not here to be a snitch.
You know, but like, you... Sorry, continue your question.
No, I want to know, where was your brain at?
I was just remembering, like, the whole thing that happened with Princess Nokia on the L train, like, where she threw, like, a soup at a racist, you know, and stuff like that. It's like, people are fighting back, right? And to me, that is, fighting back against white supremacy is a version of fighting back against Nazis and fascism, right? And so, I think games like Wolfenstein, you can see they're leaning into it with their ad campaign right now.
Yes, they are.
Like, Pete Hines and that crew have captured that moment and done a smart job, hopefully. By doing it, is it a bit disingenuous? I don't know. I haven't played the game. I can't really comment on it. But I think it's important to know that, like, yo, these are the enemies. Like, these were not... Like, and then Wolfenstein was always weird because it was, like, fake. It was, like, you know, alt history where, like, all the machines came. It was, like, there's zombies. And, like,
they got
rocket packs. And, like, there's ion cannons that, like, dissolve people. And those are the most fun things to work on. But they're also not real, right? They're not the real history. And I remember working on Wolfenstein... When they wanted us to be super open world and stuff like that, there was a segment where, like, you would go and, like, free people from, like, Nazi jails, and there was going to be, like, teeth on the ground, like, the gold fillings removed and stuff like that.
And then, the real shit.
And then, like, and then we had discussions, like, that's too much. Mm. We can't have mass graves. We can't. And so it became this way of talking about, like, Nazis, but we wouldn't talk about the real stuff.
We only talk about the fun
fake stuff. You can make it, like, kind of palpable to an audience. Mm-hmm. And that was a really instructive moment. And I was too young to really get that then, that was kind of maybe fucked up. I mean, I knew it was something that was wrong with that, but, like...
Because, like, in your gut, you could feel like,
but I didn't know how to express it, and, like, I kind of just went with the flow. Yeah.
Well, we talked about this on so we're doing a Waypoint 101, which is, like, our, like, book club-style thing for Wolfenstein and The New Order. And one of the things that came up from a listener, like, wrote in and said, like, why is it that games always make Nazis seem super powerful? Why is it that games always make them very competent, hyper-competent, like, in charge of logistics, like, perfectly
executed? I think it's what we think of Germans, too, right?
German engineering, right?
Yeah.
Absolutely. And, like, that's an interesting thing, right? It's like, you don't see... Their cruelty is always this, like, big picture cruelty, and rarely is this other sort of cruelty, which is, like, teeth on the ground.
Yeah.
Right? And that's an interesting, like, component of that picture.
Yeah, and I also just think, frankly, people are real concerned about depictions that could be considered anti-Semitic or stuff in the industry.
Which is fair.
It is fair, but again, I think... again, having homogenous leadership teams, they don't know how to navigate the space. So they instead of navigating the space, they just go, we're not going to deal with it. Mm-hmm. And this is, again, why homogenous leadership teams need to basically end.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Okay. I was going to say we even had a question this week. Sure. We don't need to go into questions proper. But there was a question this week about the Holocaust in games and the representation of the Holocaust in games that ties right into that. Sure. And doing it right. What does it take to do that right? I'm not saying anybody here has the answer, looking at that kind of cruelty, that kind of scale of cruelty, and that kind of event that happened in history, like how do we do that right and also have a game that can sell copies? Like how does one go about navigating?
Well, so like how does a movie do it, right? How does the Schindler's List do it? How does what it does is it tries to show the cruel depiction in a real brutal way. It doesn't really back down. If anything, it doubles down on a lot of the depictions. The difference is in a video game, you're complicit by being interactive, right? So it's a lot easier to watch the violence against, you know, like Jewish folks and the other marginalized folks who were killed during the Holocaust on screen than it is to potentially witness it in a game or participate in it if you're playing as like an enemy or maybe, you know, a Nazi who turns good and tries to – whatever that story could be, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so it becomes a very different kind of feel. I think what you needed, one, is a dedication to actual historical accuracy to an extent, right? Like it doesn't have to be a real story. It can be a fake story, but like the elements, the story you're telling needs to be supported by history. And like, you know, there are scholars who spend their entire lives doing this. Are people in my industry going to those types of people and interviewing them and doing that? Some are. Not many, I feel like, right?
Yeah.
The thing is, that is already so much more work than it is to make another Call of Duty World War II game.
Right.
By the way, talking about going back to 12 years ago, right?
Yeah, I know. It's wild.
Like, World War II Call of Duty coming out,
right? We're killing a lot of Nazis
this year, really new, right? Remember when we were all tired of World War II?
Well, that's
remember
the thing
when
we were all tired of that shit? It was like, does this change? Does this moment of like, yo, fuck Nazis, should we be giving credit to like the new Wolfenstein game for yo, fuck Nazis? Or is it just like, they were going to make a game where, fuck Nazis because...
Yeah, no, they're just capturing on our... Yeah,
it's like a good...
So here's the thing. It's like these games are... They take... Usually AAA games take a minimum 2 years.
Right.
Most games, besides like maybe the sports games and some other examples. Right. And that's minimum. I've worked on 2 games that have taken 4+ years, right? Like, so 10 years of my career is on 2 games, Wolfenstein and Mass Effect Andromeda.
Right.
And Mass Effect, like, 3 is like the 2-year game in the middle.
Yeah. Right?
like the quote-unquote fast one. So these things take a while. They were going to make the sequel. I believe the New Order was successful. I know it got good reviews, and I didn't really play it, but I know it got good reviews and all that kind of stuff. What they're doing is just leaning into what the culture is, what's going on in society right now, and using it as part of the marketing campaign. I think that's shrewd.
Right.
It's potentially I can see how you can be cynical about it too. I can see why people would be cynical about it too. Right. That's fair. But I think we have to realize that it's an accident or a happy circumstance.
Right.
Happy is a word to use.
It's a weird
word.
For them, it's a coincidence that like, or it's a, I'm trying to think of the word, because maybe it isn't either, right? Like maybe the fact that like someone sat down and was like, no, the KKK should be in this game too. And like, I do want to give that, like, I don't know if you've seen that shot, but like,
oh, actually, I have
yo,
not.
There are just people in hoods that you just like,
oh, okay.
Pop.
Yo,
and
yo,
like, that's,
yo, yo, yo.
Right. And so like, that's a thought that someone had was like, okay, how would Nazis who historically already drew from the KKK, because white supremacy did not start with Hitler. How would those reincorporate? How would they integrate? Like, would there be all of that stuff does suggest a degree of artfulness and study that like suggests something. So I'm very curious.
Yeah. So maybe they had a game going, and then when the election happened, and they realized this rise, or even before the election, we were already seeing this kind of rise.
Yeah,
so maybe someone smart and hopefully was started leaning into it. And you know, shout out to
Machine Games.
Shout out to them for doing it.
Also, we didn't say it before, but shout out to Visceral and anybody who did lose their job.
Yeah. Yes. Straight up, I'm real sad to see. There's a lot of good people over there. There's a lot of good. Here's the thing about when studios close down. Mm-hmm. The good people are the ones who lose their jobs.
God.
Do you know how many good people there are at BioWare Montreal? Now, a lot of them moved over to Motive and stuff like that, or have taken other jobs. But, like, I worked with some really good quality people.
Yeah.
There was just a lot of impediments above us that I think, like, you know, kind of created a lot of issues.
Right.
And they're the ones who suffer. So when a Visceral goes down, it's not like Visceral sucked. It's like there's probably 75% good people there and 25% that ruined it. And those 25% that ruined it are probably the ones who are going to get another high position job.
They're going to fail
upwards.
It's
the way this industry works. They're going to fail upwards. Right. They're going to be in a leadership position at that Vancouver studio or some other shit and fail it again, right? Because this is how EA operates. This is how these companies operate.
Well, there's the other thing here, too, is I was thinking a lot about the EA stuff, not to go all the way back to that, but the notion of time and how long games take should also be thought about when it comes down to like what happened here. This is a game that had been in development for 3 years, supposed to come out in 2019. Yeah. I don't know. That's a 5 year or a 4 year and a 4.5 year dev cycle, something like that. Yeah.
Probably a couple year pre-production with Andy and those folks.
Yeah.
A lot of people came out and were like, well, it can't be the death of the single player game because we got Breath of the Wild, because we got Lost Legacy, because blah 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 blah. It's like, well, those games came out this year. What would those games look like if they did have another 2 years on it? Like, what I'm curious about is like when The Last of Us 2 comes out, like, what's the multiplayer look like there? Because The Last of Us 1 did have multiplayer, did have like I think it did have loot boxes in that multiplayer. I think Uncharted 4 did have loot boxes in its multiplayer.
Yeah, you can see that. You can see that publisher effect go pushing into all these studios. They have to, like, they have to answer
and
for
so
the money.
I am curious to see what that stuff looks like in a couple of years. Like, I promise you, Red Dead is gonna have like some real multiplayer money shit in it because GTA 5 Online did and like does good money for them. Like it does. People love GTA Online. Yeah. And so I'm not going to be surprised.
Customize your horse. horse decals.
Like I'm going to joke about
horses,
it, but like,
you know, tailor.
Like, I pay money for horse decals.
Like, horse decals? Are you kidding me? Like, would you get like a cool spot on the horse that looks like a star? Or like, people would do it.
Horse tattoos.
Someone would get a horse tattoo.
Yeah.
Or like a dope jacket.
On the top of the horse was a unicorn.
It was a unicorn. Like spend that. If you buy a different Take-Two game, right?
If they had
a unicorn pack.
Yeah, unicorn pack, exactly. Then you can roll with
pre-order
it.
Pre-order
right?
bonus.
But
yeah.
Like, I do think that stuff is going to be in there. I'm very curious. I don't know.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me. I think you're spot on with a lot of that.
We'll see. I'm like very cautious about making big proclamations because of what you said before, which is like, we've been here before so many times. The question for me that ends up being like, well, how long is this dip? It's not, is it gone forever? It's not, this is the end of single player games. It's like, okay, what's this mean for?
Yeah, it's like local minima versus, you know, we're in a little valley.
Right, exactly.
Can I ask, something I've always been curious about, and don't answer, obviously, if you can't, but is there ever like an elitism within big teams towards, you know, the people working on the bespoke single player content versus the people working on loot boxes, multiplayer, things like that at a game like an Uncharted, where it's like, oh, people think of it as being a, you know, single player adventure, but there is of
like
course a whole
where
team working on multiplayer stuff. I don't know. I've just always been curious if that
yes
exists.
Yes and no. I think there's things that people want to do more.
Sure. Mm.
So like I can say from the gameplay team, right? Like a gameplay team, like, oh, we have to make combat and stuff like that, but we also have to make the multiplayer card packs. And
sure.
We also have to have the distribution of that, and you also have to have like, when you level up the character, what is that power curve look like for an RPG and stuff like that? Like, oh, is that all plot out in an Excel spreadsheet? Right. People have to do
are
that.
Those different curves for multiplayer versus
probably like I didn't do them personally,
okay,
right? Because like that's not something I'm strong at, right? Okay. There's other people, and so the things I was strong at were like moment to moment gameplay. Like, what's that 30 seconds of fun? Mm-hmm. What's that like? What's the game feel like? Right?
Yeah.
And other people are really good at the behind the scenes math stuff and stuff like that. And sometimes people are good at it but don't want to do it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So for example, I got kind of tired of building combat in games because I built it for 12 years and I played every shooter on the market for like a good period of my life. And I don't play combat games anymore. I basically don't play AAA games anymore because I'm bored with it and I've done so much of it that I've kind of been there, done that, and I'm just going to explore the rest of life. So I wouldn't say that there's like, oh, I'm doing this, I'm better than you. Right. At least I haven't seen. I'm sure there's some people who feel that way. There's always somebody. But like, there are like, oh, you have to do the crappy work on this month or like this 6 months, or you got this feature that sucks. Yeah. For example, I got cover on Mass Effect Andromeda. I did not want to do cover.
Sure.
And like we decided as a group for a variety of reasons, basically because of how hard cover is to do, to make it automatic. And I was like, that's going to come with this set of problems.
Right.
And we are never going to get past a certain level of quality, no matter how much we do, because we're guessing. And it's always going to be different than the player walking to cover hitting A. But I sucked it up and I did my best job and I worked with some great programmers and animators and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I think we delivered a solid version of cover, like, you know, from what that is. Definitely has flaws. And I know, like, yeah, it wasn't my favorite thing to work on. And I when I got the things that I liked working on, that's when I found more, you know, I relished those moments. And,
sure.
You know, I kind of was like, yo, take this in for a second. Yeah. Remember that, like, when you're gritting your teeth and sad for weeks at a time working on this, like, same thing, that you got to build Jump as well. And you built a little hover in the game, and that shit was lit.
Nice.
And it was fun as hell to build. Yeah. And, like, it was fun to test, and, like, it was cool.
What is the, like, what is the opposite side of that where it's like, okay, you've done the thing that you've worked on, you've worked your ass off on it for years, and then it hits, it releases, and someone is like, my animation's bad. And, like, everybody says it. Because, like, Andromeda, right? Like, you obviously work with those people, obviously, or you did at the time, and you knew them. Like, is that just, like, low morale when that hits, when it's just, like, no one – everyone
I mean, I was gone from the office there, but, like, I talked to all those people, and, like, everyone was depressed.
Yeah. Was that, that wasn't a situation where it was, like, you ship it knowing that this is going to get
so
dragged.
We knew there were going to be bugs.
Okay.
But I think the level of bugs that actually shipped were a lot higher. So it's this thing of, like, you know there's going to be bugs. We're going to fix a lot of it day one patch.
Right.
And then, like, it was, like, two patches later because we're coming in so hot and, like, you can't move the dates and, like, that big of a game. And EA does this a lot and a lot of companies do this a lot. This is an unfortunate thing. It's, like, every Battlefield game comes in late. Every
games come in late.
Call of Duty game comes in late. Games come in late, especially the biggest games. Yeah. They come in the latest and the hottest, right? Like, it's like a meteor about to strike the Earth. So you see all that stuff happening, and you recognize it. But this was levels worse, right? And the thing that really happened, I think, with Mass Effect was memes. Yo, memes will destroy you. Yeah. Ask me to know. Shout out to Meek, though. Wins and losses are great.
Yes.
But memes will kill you. And, like, when those goofy-faced memes went, that Mass Effect drama was
that
done.
Was it.
It was done.
Yeah,
it was dead. Right?
Yeah.
And, like, I saw that happening. I'm somebody who understands social media very well, I feel like. And I was like, oh, it's not good.
Right. And how do you make a meme-proof game in 2017?
A big
don't release your
game.
Right,
that's the other thing.
Don't release your game 6 months before it needs to be released. But unfortunately, you burn through all your money, and you're not going to make a profit if you don't
if you don't do it. Yeah. Or I mean, is it you won't make a profit, or is it you won't make a profit big enough for what you want it to be?
Well, I mean, that's the whole thing we were talking about earlier, right? Like, you know, EA doesn't want like $10 million or $20 million. They want $500 million. They want $1 billion, right? And so when you're only chasing the biggest goose eggs, you're going to get cut for any small reason, right? That's why the Star Wars game is canceled. I guarantee you that Star Wars game could be profitable.
Well, like, remember, that game isn't canceled. That's the thing that's interesting.
It's
like,
it's canceled. It's just
flipping my question is, like, or is it going to be like they spent 3 years developing assets? Those assets are going to go
somewhere.
That's what I mean.
But for all intents and purposes, they're closing a studio.
Right.
Like, maybe Amy's sticking around. I have no idea if she is. I hope.
I don't know. I'm not sure if Amy's sticking around.
Sure. I adore Amy. I think the world of her. I think she's super talented. And one of the few women voices that we have in our industry.
I mean, that was, like, part of the thing that was dope about like, that and that video that EA put out a few years ago with the Star Wars shit was, like, you know, Amy is there. Jade Raymond is there. Like, oh, man. Like, they're doubling
down on
this. And,
like, Jade was
shit.
In the office with me. Like, that Motive Studio is in the same office that BioWare was in.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, you know, I was real excited when Jade was in there. I got to talk to her and be like, hey. In my head, I was like, oh, maybe this will be a thing. It's not the case. And that's not because, like, she's not trying or doesn't care.
Right.
Because she is still, in the ultimate, like, scheme of things, not that big of a...
Not high
she's
enough.
Just one person.
You know,
Right?
Yeah, sorry. I was trying to figure out if there had been any other announcement about Amy specifically. I thought I'd seen something, but I'm not sure. So, I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, I'm guessing if they moved it to Vancouver.
They moved it to
Vancouver.
I think
it was Vancouver.
Yeah.
I feel like she's probably not there. But
that's
like,
what I'm saying.
I'm guessing. This is complete speculation. Nobody published this on the internet and said, I know this for you.
Right.
I don't know. It's an interesting time in video games.
It is. Video games are... They are a thing. They're amazing and also trash sometimes. This is the way this industry goes, unfortunately.
Yeah.
The one conclusive thing we can say at the end of the podcast. So, Manver, thank you so, so much for being here. I know we have to close up. There's probably somebody trying to kick us out right now. We've got like a minute to like close up. But do you have a website? Do you want to shout out your Twitter? Where do you want people to follow you and stick
you
around
can,
for
yeah,
news?
You all can follow me on Twitter at ManverHair, ManverHeir, or on Instagram at King Curry Thunder.
Good
nice.
Name.
That's my rap name.
Extremely good.
Nice.
King Curry Thunder. Watch out for the mixtape, maybe.
Wait, but no, what was it? It was like 70 C's or whatever?
There you go, 70 C's.
more C's. That's right.
Yeah, it'll be my own alphabet slaughter. Yeah, just be exactly. All C's. Right? I'll get Papoose. I'll get Papoose
Please,
on the track.
Where's Can Papoose? Is Papoose okay?
Probably boot up with Remy right now. Because wouldn't you be if you got Remy?
Of course.
The queen of BX.
Is that true anymore, though?
Oh, Remy's still the queen. Mm, I mean, Cardi. Okay.
Oh, yeah. Cardi.
I'm Barty Gang all day.
I'm just saying.
If Cardi can
Did
keep it going.
Did you see her on, was it on Kimmel the other day?
Oh, I didn't see her on Kimmel. Oh, my gosh. I saw her at the BET Awards.
So she came out on Kimmel the other day, and the stage just had, like, a snack, like a New York style side, like sidewalk snack stand on it, and I was like,
"That's amazing."
She made it. So she made it from Vine to here.
I was talking to a friend of mine because I've loved Cardi for a while,
right.
And like when Bodak Yellow kind of just climbed the charts to become this number one hit, mm-hmm. I was like, "Holy crap, this is happening! This is amazing!" And I was talking about like her going from like the strip club,
right,
to like hustling hard to getting on Love and Hip Hop,
yep,
to then getting a deal with Atlantic. And like getting two mixtapes out in 6 months, mm-hmm. and you can see like she's really worked on her skill.
Yes,
because she wasn't the best rapper.
No,
but she's a hard worker.
Yes, hard work
will outperform like talent a lot
like
of
pure,
the time.
Like right.
Yeah.
Yep.
And I was like, I kind of view my 12 years in AAA as like those are my stripper years, and like now I need my Bodak Yellow.
Right.
So hopefully the next thing I'm up to, you'll hear about my Bodak. Hopefully in the next couple of years, you'll hear about my Bodak Yellow.
Bodak Yellow. Yeah. Oh, man, Bodak Yellow. That's good. I'm excited. Yeah. Bodak Yellow 2. Just call it that.
It'll be Bodak Brown, I guess. But
Bodak Brown.
There you go.
That's good. That's all right.
We have so many podcast names for today. We have so many episodes.
I don't know, but what was it? Urban.
It was Urban White.
Urban White is a pretty good podcast name.
Urban White.
I'm really rooted for that one. I'm just putting my vote in.
All right, we might go with that one.
If you were a rapper, which rapper would you be?
If I was, I'm wearing a
you're
camera.
You're wearing a camera.
I'm wearing
there
a
we
camera
go.
Shirt. camera on it. Get set. Andre 3000, man. Okay. Andre 3000 is the goat, like all time.
That's my only.
He's
last
a unicorn. He is the black unicorn.
Yes, he is.
Sorry, Tiffany.
Shout out to. I just like just because he isn't around anymore. I just kissed him.
No,
I
mean, he's still dropping good verses on like the Frank
true.
Ocean.
That solo reprise is maybe the best.
You know, that's all I need from Andre. Is the occasional verse.
That's fair.
Love that man forever.
All right, I'm gonna let you go. I'm gonna stop asking you.
Hey, you guys should. Oh my god, I want to hear your hip hop podcast.
Oh, can we just do? Yeah, we
I
want
to hear that.
I need to learn
from people who know what the fuck they're talking about. That's the real thing. Like,
if
I need
only
to learn.
We had time.
Yeah,
I know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I know. Well, I'll do my thing real quick. Thank you again. Really appreciate you coming in. Send questions. Any questions you have to gaming@vice.com. Subject question. Shout outs to Bowen, of course, letting us use his track "Miss You" off the EP Pale Machine. Of course, we're on Twitter. Waypoint. Is Waypoint, and on Facebook it's uh-huh. Waypoint Vice. Sorry, I had
got
to like
it.
It was like concatenated in my head. I was like Waypoint Vice. There we go. Of course, on YouTube, Waypoint Vice. Shout outs to Rob Schulte for producing our podcast. I have been Danielle. You can follow me at DanielleRI on Twitter. Austin, where can people find you?
At Austin_Walker.
Amazing. Waypoint.vice.com for everything we do. And of course, I'm gonna say be good. Or be, no, be good and be good at it. That is the message.
You gotta be both.
From now on, you gotta be both. It used to be or, now it's both. You gotta be both.
Peace.
Yep.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.